You end the first poem in your book with a contemplation, which I want to ask you. Phil, what are we to do with all this living?
That is a tough question to answer, and I think its open-endedness is why I began the book with it, because it applies to everything and everyone. So it's universal in scope, but very, very specific to every single person in their life and what they're doing.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with poet Philip Schaefer about his award-winning collection of poems, Bad Summon. Your book is called Bad Summon, and it's dark and haunted by death. So why begin with this focus on life and living?
Because of the obsessions with death while living, and the fact that whether in poetry or another art form or as a doctor, you are encountering your own mortality and other people's mortality. It's more of an existential turmoil than it is necessarily a physical one.
Will you take us into the book by reading Suture?
Of course. Suture. The moment we say alone, we are not. The sun tucks under the mouth of a mountain, yet still light fills our skin. Every day, a heart is pulled out like a wet plum from one body and placed inside another. Every day, someone comes home to a lover, packing her bags. It is normal to fall asleep in pain and wake with more. We break open clouds by waiting long enough. Behind this midnight, other midnights trace a face so familiar we touch our cheekbones like twin moons. With closed eyes, we wonder what we are to do with all this living.
And the book is divided into three sections: liminal static, hideous, miraculous, and hell feelings. Can you briefly describe each of the sections?
Sure. I think the first and last sections were sort of mirror each other in terms of their scope and their interest, infatuation, and ability to confront the natural world with violence. I chose those titles based off of sound and love for language, especially liminal static. It doesn't necessarily mean something specific to the book unless you read into it. The second section, Hideous Miraculous, was published as a chapbook by Boat Press, and they do really cool things, cool design, publish good content. So I was lucky enough to work with them there. And that's a much more interior, domesticated kind of relationship-forward scene, if you will. It's sort of packed with vignettes of a relationship dissolving. And I think that I wanted to be cozied up in between the two bookending sections, which have a lot more of that feral component to them. And because when the book was accepted for publication by the University of Utah Press, they said I couldn't title the entire book Hideous Miraculous, which is what I submitted it as. So I came up with Bad Summon based off of a poem that's in the book. And that sort of being an aggregate of a conjuring that I felt was happening in the sense that the poet was divorced from the stuff he had written, and it was just left in my lap, and I felt sort of completely removed and completely a part of it at the same time.
What do you say to friends or family members or critics when they ask, what does this mean?
I usually say something like, Mom, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I don't need to go to rehab yet that I know of. And I also say the whole point of poetry is not to land at meaning that is objective, but to arrive at your own personal conclusions, because the poem should reflect some sort of shared experience. And that shared experience doesn't need to be literal by any means, but that's how language works.
I really want to dive into my sense of the speaker in a bit, but I want you to read a poem from Luminal Static first.
Barbiturate Talismania. This sadness, this halved skull filled with wildflowers. We arrive on a rickshaw of night clouds, winter air draped around us like a beached blue animal, wet and dry as silk, cocoon gauze. What dies inside these chambers doesn't matter. Some blood moons implode and become a miracle of tossed snow without body, without obituary. We sew webs in dark attic corners. Our chests widen into lakes deep enough for someone beautiful to drown in. We let them. This is how desire shapes like a map. We disappear.
I love that last line. I also want to take on the moon here, Phil. In your book, the moon appears throughout.
Thought you were going to say 400 times.
Yeah. Twin moons, blood moon, full moon, two moons. And the moon is one of those words that I was taught, you know, you steer clear from in poetry. And as I was reading it in the context of this conjuring, I was thinking, you know, is the moon this like benevolent equalizing force for all the horror? Or of what is it representing to you?
I think it's less about what it represents and more about its distance and unknowability. And on a more straightforward level, I used to, while writing this book, whether I knew it was going to be a book or not, I used to go outside late at night with a glass of wine and half a cigarette and let the stars and the moon kind of soak me in. And therefore, the language came because I would go back inside and write immediately. And how could those words not become a part of my vocabulary on the page? At the same time, there's a great Magnetic Fields line, fantastic band, and they said the simile, like the moon needs poetry. So maybe it's the opposite. Maybe we don't need the moon, but the moon needs the poem.
There are other nouns that repeat.
Mm-hmm.
Blood, arrow, whale. Can you speak to the nature of some of these objects?
Yes, it's probably similar in the sense that they have this foreignness and this allure to them. I can't think of anything more interesting than whales because they are so wholly other in every sense. And at the same time, I'm teaching a little workshop right now, and I'm telling my students concrete language, nouns, images, verbs, get rid of your adjectives and adverbs until you know how to bring them back in to the poem. And so you're going to see across my writing arrows, moons, whales, all of it. And that doesn't end for me. I'm still writing a lot, and these words keep coming up because we have our obsessions and fascinations, and you have to trust your core and trust your instincts and say, sorry, critics, here's my middle finger. I'm going with this.
In the section Hideous Miraculous, you begin several poems with the phrase, in this one. What's the context for that beginning?
This section is my favorite just because it's very different to me than the rest. My wife, Natalie, went back to the Midwest. We live in Montana, and for a weekend a few years ago to visit family. And in some sort of hangover-induced melodrama, I imagined the possibility or realm of my existence without her on a more permanent level. And I just wrote a few poems, and those poems became 26 of them or whatever. And the through line was in this one. And that's what I meant when I said earlier about them being vignettes, about that having the glue or tether to combine all of the poems together. And I thought in this one allowed for a personal component that's self-aware, that knows the melodrama exists but doesn't care anyway.
Will you read In This One You Haven't Left?
Sure. In this one, you haven't left, and the lilacs aren't devastating. Fact, I'm being dramatic. A knife undresses butter in my good hand, and I have that. I nibble on a biscuit, tell myself I'm attractive, biting the corners of my mouth with the crumbles, taste blood. And I will say, this was the first poem I wrote for this section, and the rest came out of that.
So how would you describe the speaker then of this section and also the book? You know, does it vary by section, or what's your relationship also to the eye?
I don't think it varies too much, but this section is completely the eye, so the speaker is singular, whereas the first and third sections contain a lot of that plural we, which is a bold move, I think, for a writer to include everyone on the planet, in a sense, in that sort of observation of the world we live in. And I tried anyway. They're definitely related, but there are differences. Not that I can exactly pinpoint them.
Mm-hmm. There are also many mentions of the words emotions and feelings, but not necessarily specifically named. And of course, there's this section, hell feelings. And to me, these mentions felt like chalk outlines for the reader to fill in with color, you know, and I was curious what your intention was behind leaving these like place markers of like, here's a feeling or a nod to an emotion, but I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Right. Good question. I don't know. I would say that I can't tell you or anyone what to feel or how they're feeling, but I know they're feeling it. That sort of abstract yet very honed in gut response to some situation. And I think you're right. It's a chalked outline. Now fill it in, you know, green or red, whatever you want. Yeah. And it also harkens back to the fact that while using concrete language as the focal point for my own writing and poetics, I like to challenge myself to do the opposite, to do what I tell other people not to do, because that's the cruel world we live in.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Philip Schaefer about his award-winning collection of poems, Bad Summon. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. One of the things I found fascinating was to know that you're a white man who's also writing about feelings, and there are these beautiful moments of sentimentality and dependency. And then, of course, there's this violence. In the poem, Another Language, you write, I have an addiction to stories like these. And I wanted to know, what are the stories that you're compelled by, and what do you know about the compulsion?
I moved to Missoula for graduate school summer of 2012 from Chicago, Illinois. I spent 4 years in Chicago flipping through the paper, turning on the news, seeing a death count kind of on the screen without any faces or names or true empathy because I couldn't understand it. It was sort of like reading a fairy tale gone bad. And moving to Montana, where the population is much less, you encounter crimes in a way that every single one feels like it was your neighbor's neighbor or in your backyard. So when I learned of a couple taking their honeymoon in Glacier National Park shortly after moving here, getting in an argument, her pushing him off to his death, everything in me felt. And when the high school German exchange student was essentially booby-trapped in a garage by someone here in Missoula and shot to death, I felt. So those are the stories that have not stopped. They keep happening. And when you pair them against the majesty of the place in which we live, mountains, rivers forking and splicing through town, just everything, it's so weird to have that juxtaposition, to have humans behaving so badly, so violently, and then you turn the other eye and you just see complete natural glory. Mm-hmm. So that's where my obsessions lie. That's where my addictions to this exist. And it's not enough to report, but I don't necessarily know what all to do next as that white male living without these particular repercussions, you know? And maybe that's what I want to do, is call it out and include myself.
What do you know about your own interior emotional terrain?
I know that it's a roller coaster over a long, long period of time. It's not a 30-second ride. So when I experience these emotions, these hell feelings, they come in waves, and not just by season. They come in personal seasons. They come in gaps. Sometimes they're a month long. Sometimes they're 2 years long. And I can only, when I'm out of them, start to see what was going on inside my head, which all my friends tell me I exist a little too much inside my head. Stop overthinking it, Phil. And that applies to everything in my life. The practical little daily tasks to your wife isn't leaving you.
I have to tell you, I sat with this book over the last week in the wake of this Florida school shooting, and I wanted to ask the speaker, you know, what is the nature of mass shootings? And I don't know if you have an answer, Phil, but I'm curious.
I certainly don't have an answer or one that would provide any peace or resolution, but I would say don't turn away. And that has to be step one. And then from there, try to find tangible ways to contribute to the opposite of this. I've seen so many little memes and posters and write-ups on social media about what enabling teachers with guns would mean, and every single one of them has a statistic attached to it that says this is a very bad idea. So we have to keep fighting. And I don't know how that materializes, because I think it changes wherever you are. But it begins with conversations. It begins with poems and art and realizing that it matters.
I'm going to switch gears because I think it's important in the context of your work to know that there are moments of levity. And one of these appears in Hideous Miraculous. And I was hoping that you would read, "Yesterday I Found Myself Awake."
Sure. Yesterday I found myself awake in the shower with my shirt on, searching for my breastbone like a doorknob in a hallway that doesn't exist. In this one, I am learning how to say sponge without moving a muscle. I contemplate what it means to twitch. Contemplate which Dakota I'd rather live in, having never been. You told me the Midwest was like two dogs greeting each other. I don't understand anything without distance. In this way, I am like you. Greedy, not sorry.
I love this image of two dogs greeting each other. And I also wanted to ask you now, have you been to the Dakotas, and which would you choose to live in?
I have. And probably South Dakota.
Any reason?
Nature.
Moving into the realm of craft, almost all of the fiction writers that I've spoken to on the program cop to have begun their writing lives as poets, and they usually preface it by saying bad poets, and you're lucky, you know, those are in the basement somewhere. And I was thinking, like, what makes a writer, like, double down on poetry and commit to it? And so I wanted to know, you know, how did you not abandon ship? When did you get your start, and why poetry?
For me, and I can only, you know, respond to this on my own terms and from my own experience, it was a move away from philosophy, which is what I have my undergraduate degree in, and a love of language. And I took one class as a junior, 20 years old or whatever, and it changed the way I thought about words. And then I took 4 years off, and I just wrote and wrote and wrote. I wrote a lot of what you would call, you know, memoir, creative nonfiction, and I got to a point where I was actually torn. Do I apply for graduate school in this genre or that genre? And I had a really good friend of mine who's familiar with my work just look at me and say, you have to do poetry. And I said, okay. And I only applied to graduate schools in poetry. We all write prose on a daily basis, but the poem took me and I didn't take it. And I just had to sort of submit in that sense. And it's not lucrative.
What are your day jobs or night jobs?
I bartend a lot. I bartend 3 different venues in Missoula, usually 5-6 days a week. But it's a hard town to make a good living wage. And I think the nature and perspective of bartending isn't what it used to be, where you're a single mom taking a cigarette break from the diner to pay for rent. I think there is a more elevated, if that's the right word, I'm not sure, but status that I've realized I'm okay with. I love bartending. I love working on my feet. I love socializing. I love cocktails and talking to people about them. I appreciate wine and food. It's a good thing, and it really allows me to separate the church and state of my two beings, which is social bartending and intimate, close reading and writing.
You have these breathtaking lines in your work. One, they both come from the middle section. It's all I can do not to be wild, and I cannot actually touch my heart. Do you know when you've hit like a home run line?
Only when someone tells me I have.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there are maybe times where I'm like, ooh, that feels good. But, you know, we're validated by our peers, right? So Jeff Whitney, a good friend of mine and close collaborator, he usually tells me when I've hit a home run line.
I want to get into the conversational nature of poems, and especially with Jeff Whitney, in a second. But before that, there's this rumor about you in the poet world.
Uh-oh.
I'm not sure you're aware. Was that when you're faced with rejection, that you immediately send out another submission? And I was wondering, number one, is that true? And also, what is your relationship between your work getting accepted and rejected?
It may have taken a year or two to formalize or materialize this perspective, but after realizing that it's like a cocktail, a poem comes and a poem goes, and if someone doesn't like it, send it back. You'll make another one, you'll drink another one, you'll write another one. And I am okay with that. I'm not going to bring someone back to life with a poem if I think of it that way. So I just write, and I write, and I write, and I send out because I have a resilience or thick skin or whatnot. It doesn't mean rejection doesn't sting. It hurts every time still, and I think it will for the rest of my life. But I kind of smile back. I just say, hey, you know, I'm coming for you. And it doesn't mean that will work for everyone. I have been extremely lucky. I never thought in a million years I'd have a book published. And I'm so grateful and humbled for this thing. And it doesn't feel like an ending point either. And whether it's another book someday or not, I'm still writing because it's about the poem. It's about the page. It's about interacting with your experiences and understanding their variances. But yes, I essentially submit my work immediately after finding rejections.
Will you read Temp Oral for us?
Sure. Temp Oral. If the uvula is actually a wishbone for the throat, go ahead. break your heart on mine. Your whale dreams. The pot of nail soup thawing in the garage has nothing in common with the dartboard of ducks hushing beneath the town pond. Everything has its own way of breathing and then not breathing. You are exactly one cosmos. I open your mouth with my finger in search of harmony, undiscovered asteroids. In other words, what opens like a cave has no room for birds, just a chandelier of ice melting into what it won't become.
You have written two chapbooks with the poet Jeff Whitney, who lives in Portland. And recently he had a poem published in Glass called Dear Phil, and I want to know, what is the origin of this exchange?
Jeff and I have now been writing together solely via Facebook Messenger for probably 4 to 5 years. It's bounced between every night of the week to once a month, and varied over time. But we are married in the sense of how we understand and approach the poem. And we found out pretty quickly on, having never lived in the same town at the same time, that we just shared an aesthetic, we shared an appreciation, and our voices had enough similarity and enough difference to mesh. At least we were going to give it a shot, and we found some success with it. And this particular series was just us thinking, let's be epistolary. Let's write the way that, as if we were across seas from each other and needed to communicate because it meant so much to us. So we wrote these letters back and forth, Dear Phil, Dear Jeff, Dear Phil, Dear Jeff. And we have almost a full-length body of work that we might be sending out soon. We sent out as a chapbook, again, these poems. And I think it was a finalist with Salt Hill a year ago or something like that. But nothing, no dice yet.
In this poem that I read, Jeff writes, I don't know if we catalog our griefs or pull them along like so many tin cans behind the wedding car. I don't know if you can hear mine clinking, but they're here in this room and everything I am. You too, right? How would you answer that today?
Yes, you too, right? And I think that is a perfect imagistic summary of everything I just said. They're clinking inside us. They're clinking around us. And the metaphor is always about what you're going through.
Philip Schaefer lives in Missoula, Montana, where he slings cocktails at three local establishments. Look for more information about his poetry at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.